Okay, thank you, Mara. So usually, I know Herb thanked the organizers when he spoke. I want to thank the participants, because the worst thing to do is organize a conference and nobody comes. So thank you all for being here to make this worthwhile. When I was thinking about what I was going to talk about, I went through a couple of possibilities. And ultimately, I decided to talk about something which I'm in the throes of working on. It's a hard problem. It's something that I've been working on for the past couple of years in fits and spurts, and actually realized I was thinking about it way back in grad school, and my advisor told me not to, but I did anyway for a little bit. And I'm glad that I did, because there are some resonances with some things that have been talked about already this week, so I had to change my talk a little bit to try to incorporate that. And so I'm going to talk today, the title is Max Ent, Real Numbers in Fundamental Physics. But the fundamental problem I've been trying to think about is, what is the information content of a real number? And that's a question that arises in a number of contexts. So I want to start out by telling you my conclusions, and then talk about how I get there. I will say that doing this has sort of led me into an area of mathematics that we don't typically encounter, items in set theory. In some ways, it's the hardest area of mathematics I've tried to work with, because it's just a very different way of thinking from the analysis, the geometry, the algebra that we are used to, even amongst mathematicians. So the driving question, if you really had to put it in a nutshell, is, what is the information content in a real number? How do we characterize that? So I'm going to start out by talking about some reasons that I think there's a question to think about here and to address and a problem to solve. I'm going to turn, in thinking about information, to take James's maximum entropy principle, and that's going to be a driving philosophical principle to the way I'd like to approach this. Among the consequences is that we will be led to some notions of kinds of real numbers that set theorists encounter, that I hope that I will explain, and you obviously ask questions and pester me in that way. But that suggests that different ways that we talk about physics and think about physics actually imply that we're using different subsets of the real numbers. I mean, they're all dense and so forth, but they're fundamentally different. In a technical sense, sort of what the big dream would be if this all worked out would be using a set theoretic notion called forcing, which I only barely understand at this point, to develop a theory of information that works not just for the finite case, but for infinite cases with infinite possibilities, what I might call a transfinite theory of information. And along the lines of that, I'll point out a certain class of real numbers that have an interesting property that maybe suggests that you could think of them as sort of atoms of information within the real numbers. But I will say that this is very much open, and I think if I'm fully honest about this, this is a case where I've gone into an area, there are clearly connections to these set theoretic notions, and figuring out how it all fits together is the real puzzle and the real challenge. So in terms of what's puzzling about real numbers information, I want to make reference to 4 points here. These aren't the only 4 points that I could make reference to. One of them is Herb Bernstein's talk, one is Bill Wooter's talk, and then two other points that I had already planned to talk about before I came here. So the first one has to do with the question of superdense teleportation. And if I don't think of teleportation in terms of the quantum states, but just think of it as a numerical problem, the idea is that in ordinary teleportation, I take two classical bits, Alice sends two classical bits to Bob, and from that, Bob is able to reconstruct two real numbers, the co-latitude and the longitude that describes the situation of the qubit. But if I think about it that way, the question is, why should I be limited to one real number per qubit? Now, superdense teleportation says I shouldn't be. But if I think about real numbers, I shouldn't be surprised by that at all, in a certain respect, because there doesn't seem to be any more information content in two real numbers than in one real number. I can take two real numbers, the one in purple or the one in brown. These are their decimal expansions. And I'll just think about two numbers. In general, I'll think about numbers between 0 and 1. So whenever I say real number, I'm probably actually thinking about real numbers between 0 and 1 for convenience. And I can take these two numbers, and I can interleave their decimal expansions, and I get a single real number. So in what sense does it make a difference if I'm communicating two real numbers or one real number? And if that's the case, why should I be limited to two classical bits communicating two real numbers as opposed to 17 or 549 or whatever your favorite number is? We'll come back to that towards the end. So that's one interesting puzzle. This is maybe less a puzzle, but more a way of thinking about what Bill Wooters was talking about. In the coin game that Bill described, of how would you use, I design a coin, and then Alice sends that coin to Bob, and with that coin, Bob is going to reconstruct a real function. And I think one way to think about the processes that Bill is describing is this kind of metaphorically impedance matching between what happens if I have a discrete set of outcomes and I'm trying to describe a real function with information characterized by the set of real numbers. And how do I get from one to the other? Now, we encounter these questions about information content in real numbers in other places too. If I think about classical chaos, like the solar system, right? This is a chaotic system. If I think about the position of an object, if I don't specify the position of an object exactly its full real number, but I have some little interval, then ultimately in the future, its position effectively fills all of phase space. It doesn't literally. You still have Liouville's theorem, but any point in phase space is arbitrarily close to some point in the sort of space that this thing fills up. But as Hooft has pointed out, if you look at nature, Saturn goes to a particular place. It doesn't spread out over phase space. So at least the way classical mechanics is implemented, and the world seems to work well classical mechanically, it's as if the system, classical systems do know the full information, the full real number position of things, because after all, they decide to go somewhere and not somewhere else. Mathematically, if you think about information, right, we had Shannon in the late 40s, 1948, published his famous paper. And there's an interesting feature here, which is that if we take the Shannon information and just naively extend it to the continuous case and construct what's called the differential entropy, the properties of the differential entropy are not as nice and not as robust as the properties of the Shannon entropy, right? There are problems when we go to the continuous case. The most obvious thing to look at here is that if I have a probability distribution p of x rather than a set of probabilities p sub I, the naive generalization from Shannon to differential entropy need not even give me positive values. The process and the attempts to figure out how to talk about information in the continuous case, there are a lot of approaches. But I think it would be nice if we had an approach that could sort of all at once handle everything in one uniform formalism. I don't have that approach, but I'd like to suggest the area in which that approach should sit. So that's the, you might think of those four points as motivations for thinking about this problem. Maybe at another point, this is not what led me into this, but there are plenty of people who talk about the question of whether or not is the universe fundamentally continuous, is it fundamentally discrete, and those questions are out there, and maybe this has some bearing on that, but that's not what's driving this question. Now, one approach simply would be to say, though, with that notion of, is the universe real, continuous or discrete, maybe we should just abandon real numbers. Why do we need them in the first place? I'd like to argue against that, not because I necessarily think we know the answer to it, but first of all, real value physics works perfectly well, and so there's a certain effective field theory point of view that would say, since real value physics works well, we're operating in a realm where we can think about things as being real valued. Effective field theory says, therefore, we should be able to describe things in terms of these parameters, in terms of these variables, in terms of these observables. And in addition, I would say that when you have something that works well, the history of physics tells us that when there are problems with it, the best thing to do isn't to give up, it's to see how does it extend into this new realm. And I would say if there are challenges in terms of thinking about information when we deal with real numbers, we shouldn't give up and say that's a bad thing about real numbers. We should see if we can figure out a way to approach that. So my answer to that is a no. If your answer is yes, we could all go to lunch right now. So maybe we could take a vote, and I think yes would win at this point. I would not win. You had a good breakfast. Yeah. That's not right. All right. So what's the crux of the distinction between real numbers and other things we deal with? And the crux, as you're probably familiar with, is that if we look at the number of natural numbers, we look at the number of integers, we look at the number of rational numbers, those are actually all the same. Talk about that as the cardinality of the set. And those are all what are called countably infinite. So when I use the word countable here, I will generally mean not that it stops at 5 or 13, I mean countably infinite. But as Cantor showed in the 19th century, most famously by his second argument, the diagonalization argument, there are more real numbers than there are integers. These are different sizes of infinities. So I assume most people have seen this argument somewhere along the way or know this fact. And the things to think about here that make this all sort of puzzling, or not puzzling, but you know, relevant here, is so we have the size of the infinity of the natural numbers, we have the infinity of the real numbers, and they are not the same. The infinity of real numbers is bigger. The rational numbers, which are countably infinite, are certainly dense within the reals, but they also form a set of measure zero within the reals. So Cantor's argument for doing this, I should mention, was essentially a diagonalization argument. He imagined that suppose the real numbers could be put in one-to-one correspondence with the natural numbers, you make a list of all these numbers, and again, real numbers between 0 and 1, write down their decimal expansions, and then you look down the diagonal and you can create a real number that's different at each point along the way, and you say that's not on the list, so we can't do this. This idea of diagonalization, not going to go into it here, but just since we are dealing with a week that partially deals with questions of information, computation, although these don't necessarily deal with having uncountable sets, the notion of diagonalization also led to limits, discovering limits in computation from the halting problem, limits in proof theory that there are undecidable statements within any sufficiently interesting mathematical axiomatic system. That's due to Gödel. And these all sort of rely on the same notion of diagonalization. So, all right. Anything else that I want to say here? I don't think so. The particular structure of diagonalization isn't going to be critical at the moment. There's an interesting question that underlies all this. Let me go back here. With these two infinities here, this infinity is larger than that infinity. There is a long-standing question going back to the 19th century, which is whether or not there were any infinities in between. This is called Aleph Naught. The other is the infinity of the continuum. Are there any infinities in between? Do people have an opinion on this?
Undecidable.
It is undecidable. It's not an opinion. You know the result. And we'll come to that. That question of the size of infinities actually led to the mathematics that I want to be talking about. All right. Now, if we're talking about trying to generalize the notion of information to the transfinite case, we've already seen that there are challenges in using Shannon's particular form. But a little bit after Shannon, right, we had James's two famous papers in which he asserted that if you've got some data and you're trying to guess what it tells you, the best thing to do is to come up with a solution that maximizes the entropy. I mean, this is what Bill was doing in his talk with the coin game. It's sort of, you know, it's tied neatly to Bayesian statistics. But the nice thing about James's formulation is that I can phrase it in a way that philosophically isn't tied to a particular numerical way of thinking about things. Right? What James is really saying is that if you're going forward, you should assume no information other than what you explicitly have already. No information other than what is there before you. And that's how I'm going to think about the maximum entropy principle in that non-mathematical term, because then that's something which maybe we can think about when we're dealing with large sets.
Yeah. You talked about going from the pi log pi, the discrete entropy formula, to the classical.
Yes.
And the discrete one is valid for quantum states which are discrete.
Yes.
Nothing in between. And I don't want to give away your conclusion.
That's
when you go over to the continuous version, you're not putting stuff in between.
So
P of X, the X itself.
That's right. So the difference would be, so in, right, when Shannon derives everything, you imagine you have n possible outcomes where n is a finite number. So what happens if you want to have a continuous set of outcomes? And the problem is that, in fact, Shannon doesn't generalize in a natural way to that. You have to approach
this. And I'm asking the question is, by making it continuous, are you actually losing information or including?
You're looking at a different system.
Okay.
You're looking at a different system. So, right, if I'm saying, am I tossing a die or am I throwing a dart at the wall?
Okay, I'm good.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. Now, just as a side note, these questions, where can diagonalization come in? One of the things we're taught in quantum mechanics is that observables correspond to Hermitian operators. Question is, you might ask, and Mike Nielsen asked this question, I think, about 15 years ago, is every Hermitian operator, does every Hermitian operator correspond to a physical observable? We kind of think that it does. And it turns,
what's it? It's been proven in a paper I wrote for all finite dimensional open spaces.
Right, but we're not.
You want the,
I want. We don't usually have, right. I want to have an infinite dimensional, like, you know, the harmonic oscillator does not have a finite dimensional Hilbert space. And so it turns out that there's actually a tension here, information theoretically. And the answer ties into one of these other diagonalization arguments, not the one about real numbers, but it's worth knowing. There's a thesis called the Church-Turing thesis. It's a principle of computer science. It's not proven, but it basically says a computer can compute anything that can be computed. What it means is that any physical model of computation, any physical computer you can build, what it can compute is identical to what an abstract Turing machine can compute. And so far we know this to be true, but Nielsen points out that if every Hermitian operator corresponds to an observable, then the Church-Turing thesis has to be false. Yes?
Is the thesis that you can compute at least as, crudely speaking, much or as well as a Turing machine? Because quantum computers can do more than a classical Turing.
They can do it faster, they can't do more.
Okay.
Right, or potentially faster, right? But they can't do more because, well, for one thing, you could write, right, you can on a classical computer write down a simulation of a quantum computer. It might take longer to run. Yeah, so this is not about the length that it takes to run. This is not about computational complexity, just computational possibility.
Okay.
That's a good question. And the way Nielsen shows that, in fact, the Church-Turing thesis would fail if every Hermitian operator corresponds to an observable is that you could construct an observable that corresponds to one of these computationally disallowed problems by the diagonalization argument, what's called the halting problem, that you could construct a halting operator that your quantum system could measure something, and if it could measure something that we know a Turing machine cannot compute. So we construct this operator, it's clearly Hermitian, but what it computes is something that a Turing machine couldn't compute. And so either not every Hermitian operator corresponds to a physical observable, and there's some computational restriction, or the Church-Turing thesis is invalid, which would also mean that there would be things that a physical system could measure that we couldn't compute, it would also mean that all of physics wouldn't be couldn't be simulated on a computer. And we tend to think that we can simulate things on a computer. So, if, you know, most people don't want to give up the Church-Turing thesis. But the point is here, there's a tension. And so sometimes in these places where we're looking, there's tension between ideas that seem to be sitting in very different fields, but when you sort of probe at these fundamental questions, you can expose some of those. Any other questions? Yeah?
So that there's no problem in finite dimensional.
Right, right.
Well, and what if you say, consider only bounded operators, operators, does that kind of fix the problem?
Well, then you'd have to have some sort of analog for bounded Turing machines, I suppose.
Okay.
Right, and so then it's... You would... I think it would solve. Well, bounded... But you still have an infinite... What's that?
Restricting to a certain category?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think if you have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, I think as long as you have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, you have the problem. Because you would effectively construct, I mean, you know the halting problem. So you effectively just write down an operator which, by fiat, solves the halting problem, and you show that it's Hermitian. And I don't think that would change. As long as you have the infinite dimensional Hilbert space, I think you can do that. Yeah, I think it's true. I don't think
mathematical physicists, when they say Hermitian, they probably include bounded as part of
Yeah. But I'm not sure that Mike Nielsen did. I mean, not that he's a stupid guy. I mean, he's doing this in this quantum computing sort of language, not a real analysis kind of language. Yeah. All right, other questions? All right, so let me turn then to, that was just an aside, but I thought one that sort of gives a flavor for how we think. So I want to talk about what it is that we theorists of a certain ilk, at least, those of us who are sort of on the, you know, we're drawn to things like particle theory and general relativity and all those things and unified theories. What is it? What is our real dream? Our real dream is that from first principles we can calculate the universe, right? Sit down, the muon to electron mass ratio, the weak mixing angle, you know, the spectrum, everything should be able to sit down and figure out what it is. I mean, after all, the universe did it. Why can't we, right? That's the arrogance of our field. And, you know, if you asked, you know, how many free parameters are there, you might hear, you know, people might say, well, maybe zero, maybe one. But you don't want to think there are, you know, 35 free parameters. Now we have multiverse problems now and so forth. But, you know, that's sort of the theorist dream, that we can calculate where things would go. And if that's the case, then what we're saying is that we have a universe of computable numbers, right? That there's an algorithm we can specify. I don't know what it is yet, but if we've had that, we could compute everything about the universe. So if there's one free parameter, maybe there's some early thing that happens in the universe you need to know, but that gets everything going, then everything is computable relative to that number. That number is sort of like an oracle, gives you that number, and then relativized to that, again, you have an algorithm you can compute.
Weinberg's demon.
Yes. I like that. And Weinberg would like that too.
No, but I
like that. So the problem is this. If that's the case, and all the real number, all the, I have to use the word real carefully, all the actual numbers of the universe are computable, the computable real numbers are atypical real numbers. They are not what most real numbers look like. And that's because there are countably many computable reals, even though there are uncountably many real numbers. So in fact, if you pick a real number at random, odds are you're not going to get a computable real in whatever sense odds are is meaningful in that context. So a computable real, thank you, anticipated. A computable real is a number that I can give you, there's a finitely specifiable algorithm by which I can compute that real number as far as I want. So what are every real number you know is a computable real. The square root of 2, pi, the golden ratio. These are all computable numbers. 5 is also computable, but that's less interesting. So it's a number for which I have a finitely specifiable algorithm that I can unroll, and it'll tell me everything I want to know about that number. And that's why, right, even though I can't write down a full decimal expansion of pi, that doesn't mean I don't know everything in principle about it, right? That's how we do all these fancy sums and so forth and prove properties of pi. This is one thing which is endlessly confusing to non-mathematicians. They say, if the decimal expansion of pi never terminates, how do you know anything about it? Well, we know things about it because it's computable. Yeah. Probably by what you mean, yes, but there are ways to talk about numbers that are not computable. So I can't say what they are, but I can say some things about them. And we're going to encounter a set of non-computable numbers shortly.
What about just writing the phrase non-computable number?
Sure, but what is that number? I mean, you can't write down a specific non-computable number.
Oh, okay.
Right. But you can, yes, you can talk about properties of such numbers, yeah.
So in what sense is pi computable? I can't write down the machine, I can say things about pi, but in what sense is, well, we can say things about it, meaning that, in what sense does that make something computable?
So I have an algorithm I can write down that's a finite algorithm, that maybe it has to run a very long time, right? But anything I want to know ultimately will be answered by that algorithm.
4 times the arc.
So I can write down symbols, so we could say that the actual value of that number is the limit of, I could construct a series of Turing machines, the machine that gives me pi to 2 digits to 3,
yeah.
So it's the limit.
I can write down one Turing machine. I can write down a Turing machine and program it that will tell me, you know, you want to know, is the 500 millionth digit even?
Sorry, but you said anything you want to know about pi.
It's a good question. In principle, I would say that I shouldn't say anything you want to know, anything that can be proven about pi. I think it connects also, I think, to questions of provability. So there are things we don't know, like whether or not pi is a normal number, for instance, right? But in principle, the answer to that question is determined by the algorithms that specify it. Whether or not we can actually prove it is a good Gödelian question.
Suppose I ask the question like, is there ever a sequence of 100 ones in the decimal expansion of pi?
So it's possible that for sort of Gödelian reasons, it's not answerable, right? That there's not a proof about that one way or the other.
So we have to be a little more
so, right. So I would say, you know, so I guess, yeah, I shouldn't say everything you could possibly want to know, but we can specify the number there is a way to specify the number that follows from an algorithm. I mean, in a certain sense, right, there are things we don't know about the natural numbers at this point, right? Is Goldbach's conjecture true or not? So I would say that kind of question falls into the same category. Right.
Is there no proof that pi is random?
There's no proof that pi is, no, there's no proof that the digits of pi are random or normal and so forth. It's,
oh,
that's so. Well, normal means something more.
Yeah.
So would it be useful for these purposes to say that a computable number is one where we can write a program that will, in some finite amount of time, give it to as many digits
yes.
as we want?
Yeah,
yes. Yes. That will do it. Okay.
What's the number theory definition?
That's not number theory. It's this is mathematical logic. That's essentially what it would be.
But I mean, there was a famous number theorist, Ramanujan.
Yeah, yeah.
He could write down any number you give him. He would come up with some kind of an equation which would give you the number eventually. But I mean, at least that's what the myth says.
Yeah. Well, 1729 he could do.
Yeah, yeah. So my question is, the number theorists do not think about these
things? No. No, the only mathematicians who think about these things are logicians. I mean, mathematical logic, there's all of math, and then mathematical logic sits here.
Okay.
I mean, that's just the way it goes. And I say this with some authority because I have a family with three mathematical, well, actually, there are no mathematical logicians anymore, 3 PhDs in mathematical logic. So
But
every computable
anyway. Right. Yeah.
The infallible Wikipedia agrees with me, by the way. Numbers that can be computed to within any desired precision by a finite domain algorithm.
Somebody should check the edit history on that file. All right, let me move on so we can get... So, what do we do with experiment? Experimenters don't measure numbers. Experiments don't yield computable reals. They don't even really give us numbers. Experiments give us ranges. And it's... I could refine this. I'm not going to refine it here. I'm going to think of the result of a measurement as being something like this, that, you know, I measure out to some number, and it's plus or minus some range. Yes, we could generalize this by saying we have some statistical distribution, and maybe it's a Gaussian or whatever.
But they return a set of parameters rather than
the number. Right. And I want to talk about, I'll model things this way for right now, and for the purposes of this talk. So one way you could think about it is, I plug in my voltmeter, and it says 0.458. And I know that the first three digits of my answer are 0.458, but I don't know what comes after that. Right? So that's effectively giving me an interval. And here's a way to get an interval that's not based on base 10 digits. Now, what can we conclude from this? So one approach, information theoretically, if I take Jane's seriously, in terms of I should assume nothing other than what I already know, leads to some interesting things. So the first thing I note, that if I find out that my number is in this range, what is the actual number for the actual thing that I'm measuring here? The first thing to note is that in that range, nearly every number, almost every number, in the technical sense of almost every, is non-computable. So the numbers, most of the numbers in that range, are not the numbers that we fundamental theorists would like to think that we could find. But that's not the whole story. If I take Jane seriously, then I should presume no features of what the ultimate answer should be other than that the first digits are whatever I said here, 7.3, I guess, that it sits in that interval, 7.324 plus or minus 0.015. Or maybe I plug in my voltmeter and it says 0.487. I should assume nothing more than that the first three digits are 0.487, and the rest is just out there. This implies that these numbers are more than not computable. It actually says that these numbers are a different kind of real number that Paul Cohen first defined back in 1963. If I say that I've got a number whose first three digits are 0.483, and that's all I know about it, then what I'm saying is that there is nothing in that number that I know other than things I could know based on that finite initial segment, based on those first digits of the number. And Cohen talked about such numbers back in 63 for his work that led him to the Fields Medal. He introduced a notion of what are called Cohen, well, he called them generic reals. They're today called Cohen generic reals because there are other kinds. And a Cohen generic real is specifically a number that has no properties other than those which can be specified based on some finite initial segment of the number. So for instance, if I tell you that this is a number such that in its decimal expansion, 7 never appears after the millionth digit, that is not a Cohen generic real. If I tell you that of the first million digits, half of them are even, that's a Cohen generic real. If I tell you it's a normal number, which means that, among other things, every digit in the decimal expansion appears an equal number of times asymptotically, that's not a Cohen generic real. These are things in which you really can't say anything other than the fact that it's in the interval, and know nothing else about it. And what's interesting to me about this is that, I should say that talking about the decimal expansion, I could also talk about intervals in the same way. That's effectively shifting to a different basis. So if you think about the way I described this happening in an experiment, we have a number, we know
interval it lies in, and we really should say that we know nothing, experimentally, we know nothing else about it. So if we take the maximum entropy principle seriously, that would suggest to us that the plausible results of the experiment, what it's pointing to us, should be some kind of generic real that has this particular finite initial segment, but I know nothing else about it.
What about experimental resolution? I mean,
That's where the interval comes from.
Right, so maybe my definition, when I talk about,
can you talk about an experiment, I'm thinking the instrument as a resolution.
Absolutely.
Which is where the decimal points are coming from, right? So the resolution could be 10 to the minus 700.
That's still a finite initial segment. I still don't know anything. I may know something about the first 7 million decimal places.
So my question,
but I don't know asymptotically.
But then the question is it really necessary to know up to those many decimals? Will it have any effect on the actual physics?
That's a critical question, and that's ultimately the point that you'd like to know, which is what are we talking about with physics? So is physics, let's say, we frame physics as being over the real numbers. What does that mean? And what I'd say, because the point of this is to say, let's take that idea, see where it gets us to try to understand what it means to frame physics over the real numbers. Can we develop a theory of information that will work in that case, or are we in fact always limited to thinking about things? And in your case, effectively, you're saying we can discretize space, and that's.
That's why we have a perturbation parameter. If you think about the Born-Oppenheimer approximation,
yeah.
Right? Small m over capital M is approximately 10 to the minus 4. So I can, for all purposes of my theory, think of the nucleus as being stationary, and the electron is going around making as many circles as possible, and the answers that I get out of it are working. Now, I may be mistaken completely, because you might be constructing a more general idea of numbers, and I'm not completely ignorant about the field. But just thinking from a practical perspective, if I talk to an engineer,
an engineer won't care about this.
Yeah. So
That's
my question. That
this is
something like this have an actual physical effect in the effect that physicists would measure, and that would be really exciting to know that.
I tend to doubt that, but what it may tell you something about is what's the possible structure. So there are two issues here. One is, can we come up with a way to talk about information in the continuous limit so that when we treat things with real numbers, we can talk about that sensibly? But the other payoff would be that it tells you something about what a fundamental theory of physics looks like, which the engineer won't care about anyway, right? But that, you know, as we sit there and try to find out what fundamental theories look like, maybe this points to some constraints that have to be solved, maybe it doesn't. I don't know the answer to that. But
okay.
It's not an engineering issue, to be sure. So.
You may answer the question, but yeah, where there's a circularity, right? Because the maximum entropy, your statement is experiment yielded blank.
Yes.
Where that blank may imply non-computability. But you also said an experiment, which was presumably done in some universe with some laws of physics. So that prior or that piece.
No, absolutely. We'll come back to that.
That affects the sample space that you can apply max n. And I'm just wondering, is it circular?
It's not circular.
There's an assumption that gives you an implication, but you then can't use that implication to get information about the assumption.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite circular. I understand the concern, but I think it does point to the question then of, ultimately, what do we mean by theory? What do we mean by experiment? What information are we allowed to use ultimately becomes the question. And when I come back actually to talking at the end, when I come back to talk about Bill's talk, I'll actually directly address that question, if I get there. So here's the thing about generic reals. No rational number is co-engeneric. No computable number is co-engeneric. Frankly, no number you know is Cohen generic. No number Paul Cohen knew was Cohen generic. And he knew a lot of numbers. I should mention why Cohen introduced these numbers. Just as quickly, there's this question of, are there infinities between the size of the natural numbers and the size of the reals? And it turns out that's an undecidable problem. It's like Euclid's fifth postulate. You know, there could be, is there a unique parallel line through a point not on a line? Could be yes, could be no, right? you can't prove it from the other axioms. And Cohen showed this back in 1963 using a method called forcing, which involves introducing these Cohen generic reals, and he won the Fields Medal for it. That's where it all comes from. The other story is that Cohen was not a mathematical logician, and apparently he talked to the mathematical logicians and was telling them their field was trivial. And he said, what's the most important problem in your field? And they said, the continuum hypothesis. And Cohen went off and resolved it. All right.
He wasn't whatever you said, but he wasn't egotist.
Yeah. Okay. I know. He told me that. So if we take this out a little bit further then, what questions might we come up with, or what observations might we make? So the first thing is, are there other notions of genericity besides what Cohen has? And there are. There are dozens of notions, actually. It's a very rich field. One of the most interesting things is Cohen didn't just solve the continuum hypothesis. This technique of forcing that he opened up revolutionized set theory. So, egotist that he was, he certainly he had earned that ego, although he probably had it before he earned it. One of the other things that's striking to me too is that, you know, when I started doing this, I was thinking about James's principle phrased in this way of knowing nothing other than what you know ahead of time. That's sort of just an independent, was at least for me, an independent train of thought from how Cohen came up with Cohen generic reals. And yet it's the same, it really is the same notion. Cohen wasn't thinking about this information theoretically, but if you look at these reals, and if you look more generally at this notion of forcing that he developed, it really is about how do you embed information into transfinite sets. What, you know, you create a model of the axioms of mathematics, create the smallest model you can, then you add a new number into that and everything that has to go with it, and then you add something else new, and you see how each time you add something, what gets put into the theory. So it really is very much about information, even though it wasn't formulated with that in mind. So here are my comments about that. Skip that. So what we notice here, since computable numbers are not Cohen generic reals, and I'll try to go quickly here so that we can get to lunch. We have the theorist's ideal saying, we're going to compute everything from first principles. And then we have the sort of the pure, if you like, a pure experimental philosophy says, I get these numbers, but I don't know anything else. So then the expected answers beyond that would be Cohen generic reals. And computable numbers would only be expected to show up there with probability zero in a real analysis sense. So there's a tension between what we're doing when we're doing these two different kinds of physics. And so one of the things that one needs, I think, that ultimately would need to be done is say, how do we harmonize these things? How do we find a language that's really talking about both? Because if you say, well, look, the experimenter does the experimenter's thing, the theorist does the theorist thing, and you know the computable numbers are dense in the real, so that's fine, you just get arbitrarily close. What you're really saying is you have these two different things dealing with two different kinds of real numbers, but then you're embedding them in some other set that neither one talks about and using that to connect them. And that's kind of peculiar. It would, in a strict sense, answer the question that you raised about, well, but it's close enough. But then where do this set of real numbers show up in that if that's not what either side is really working with? So, and I don't have a good answer to that.
So what about divergent perturbation expansions? Like, if I do a perturbation expansion for theory, strong coupling, those things are divergent. So there is no closed form, anything. You know, when Feynman tried to solve the superconductivity problem, he tried doing a perturbation expansion, and his claim was, oh, can't solve it. So. But then BCS did the variational form and got an answer. Stark effect, that's divergent. So what I don't connect is what's the purpose of the use of knowing that entire number if beyond a certain decimal point, it has no actual, at least in physics, no observable effect. Would it change the phase of the system, make it go from disordered to non-disordered, or what's the
point? So the point is to understand what physics is. I mean, we say it's over the, I mean, one way to think about it, we say that physics is over the reals, what does that mean? I mean, again, a lot of, you know, there are plenty of things we can do that don't matter from, you know, a design perspective, an engineering perspective, but it's a question of understanding the fundamental principles that put things together. So that is the goal. The goal is not to build a new device. The goal is not to build a new device. And the only, you know, the only hope of something practical, which I wouldn't hold that a very large hope for, but it might be there, would be that if you find that you find that there's a constraint on what would be a self-consistent mathematical framework, and that it might point to the fact that, you know what, we really shouldn't be thinking about all the reals, that really the self-consistent mathematical framework says it's only the computable reals, or it's only the this. So, you know, that could sit there, and that might resolve these questions. Would it change, you know, what Elon Musk can build? Them? So, yeah.
Could I ask two trivial questions? If something is divergent, then maybe the fundamental theory should not be divergent. That's all.
Right. Yeah, right, so yeah, if you have something that's divergent, that's just...
Yeah, it's not a fundamental theory.
Yeah.
And maybe another sort of answer is there's I thought a really cool result by a guy named Tony Qubit. Yeah, Tony Qubit, right? So that's a funny name for a quantum information theorist. But he was looking at a solid-state model, and the question he was trying to... And it's with a team. I only remember his name because of his name. But so looking for whether the spectrum is gapped, whether there's a gap between the ground state and the first excited state, and proving that whether there's a gap is undecidable in the thermodynamic limit. Because you never know whether maybe you're solving it, you do it for n equals 238 million, and then you add one more, suddenly a gap could open up. In other words, he proved that particular piece of math was undecidable in the thermodynamic limit. And to me, I mean, you might say that's a sign that the model system they're trying to solve is a physical. You might say this is a sign that the thermodynamic limit is not meaningful. But so these kinds of questions, I think, are going to inject themselves into our discussion of the limits of models and whether our models, whether modeling is in itself inherently limited.
No, that's great. I didn't know that example. And I think if you take it one step further, if you really take the it from bit idea seriously, which I think we probably should, because what would Wheeler do? What would Wheeler do? Then we need to understand whether or not we can sensibly get the continuous world we describe in an information theoretic way. So thanks, Nate. That's good. All right. So let me close then with some thoughts about what you might be able to do to tie these things together. So if you look at the different kinds of generic reals, I'm not going to talk about all of them, what they all have to do with is you talk about, I only know about membership in intervals, or I only know about memberships in definable sets of finite measure, or whatever, and you use a different whatever notion you use will lead to a different notion of genericity. Now, with most kinds of generic reals, it turns out that I can start with a generic real. Okay, admittedly, I don't know what it is, but I imagine that I have one. And I have a finitely specified algorithm that acts on that generic real. Again, it doesn't have to run in finite time, but it's a finitely specifiable algorithm that will produce a new generic real. And you can come up with such things. And for most generic notions of genericity, that such an algorithm can produce as an output something for which there's no finitely specifiable algorithm that could take you back. It's sort of the ultimate one-way function. And I'll give an example in a moment. Here, of two examples of things that are reversible and one that's not, just to give you an idea of what this means. So this is, okay, can I write down a Cohen generic real? Yes, I just did, right here. This is a Cohen generic real. Well, it's not really, but. And now I have a finite algorithm that says, shift everything over two decimal places and stuff 7 and 3 in the front. Well, that's clearly reversible. I just take 7 and 3 out, shove it back. But in fact, it's sufficient to be reversible if there is a finitely specifiable algorithm, even if I don't know what it is. So here's a case where I start with my real, I throw out the first digit, and I move everything to the left, and I get this. Now, from this number, I don't know how to reconstruct that, but there is a finitely specifiable algorithm that will reconstruct it. It happens to be the one that says, add a to this and then divide by 10. Now, I don't know that just from seeing the output. I don't know what that is, but it does exist. Yeah. However, here's a transformation for which I have a finitely specifiable algorithm that will take me from one to another co-engineeric real, but which cannot be undone by a finitely specifiable algorithm, even one that I don't know. Go through this and throw out every other digit here. Throw out the B, the D, the F, and so forth. I get this. Now there is no finitely specifiable algorithm that will undo that, because there's no finitely specifiable algorithm that could tell me write down B, D, F, H, and J, because it's a co-engineeric real. Because that goes on to infinity. So in some sense, then, these are cases where the output has less information than the input, right? It's thrown information out. There turns out to be another kind of generic real. These are called Sachs generic reals. And Gerald Sachs, here, instead of being in intervals, it has to do with being in what are called perfect sets. These are closed perfect sets. So this is a set such that every limit point of the set is a member of the set, and every member of the set is the limit point of some members of the set. And when you do that, these generic reals have the property modulo one little. I mean, I'm phrasing this not the way a mathematician would be happy, but it's still true. That if I have a finitely specifiable algorithm that'll go from G to G prime, or they're both Sachs generic reals, there's always one that will come back. So these are somehow incompressible, right? There's no information I can throw out of these. Unless I throw the whole thing out, I can say, yes.
So coming back to the information part, yep. The output and input is your definition of what do you call an output, what do you call an input. Right. So if I go back to one slide before where you talk about the output has less information, what if I call the output as my input?
Well, but that's the problem. There's no finite algorithm, no finitely specifiable algorithm that will let me go from here to here. Wait, go, what's that?
If I go from right to left, there is no finite algorithm to do that.
Sure there is. The algorithm says, go through your digit, all right? Keep the first digit, read a digit, throw out the next digit. Read a digit, throw out the next digit. It runs for infinite time, but I can specify it, right? Start, read a digit, write it down. Read a digit, throw it out, go to start.
That is considered.
That's a finitely, right. Yeah, it's a finite computer program. Maybe it will run for a very long time, but infinite time in this case, yes. Right, but the program itself is finite. So it's like Kolmogorov complexity, right? What's the small or Chaitin, right? What's the smallest program you can write that will generate? And that was Chaitin's notion of complexity. But I can't write a program like that going backwards, because this is a co-engineric real, knowing these digits here tells me nothing about what the digits are later on that I've thrown out. Right? If I had pi and threw out every other digit, I could reconstruct pi. But this is a co-engineric real. So knowing these digits here cannot tell me anything about the digits out there. Because ultimately the only information that I can specify about the number is information from a finite initial segment. And so the behavior of the tail is always unknown to me. And so I can't wrap it back up. Does that answer the question, Bomov? Alex?
What you're getting at is the difference between some very finite, rigid procedure and a pattern matching brain. Because we can all look at that second sequence of letters. And we know exactly where that came from.
If it were a co-engineeric real, you wouldn't. If you have these two starter rights out, yes, we could go back. But you couldn't.
For a general transformation, but the point is that you're looking at a map. You've shown a mapping here that a pattern matching brain can figure out. And that goes a little bit to.
But not to how to unwrap it.
Well, we can sort of, we can guess what that comes from.
Only because I've written this in a very suggestive way, which is not what a Cohen generic wheel would look like. Right?
No, I agree. It's yeah. The most, a generic Cohen generic wheel would not look that way.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that there's a difference between what a set of rules could invert, just going very strictly by the rules on the paper and not stepping outside of it, and what the human brain, the set of things that the human brain can look at and invert or look at and figure out is larger than the set of things that some small set of rules can look at, which again, which is sort of related to your idea that we can work out theories of real numbers even though we aren't measuring them.
I would actually disagree with your statement about the human brain.
But Hofstadter would agree.
I think the human brain is probably Turing. It's probably just another Turing machine. So I believe in the very strong Church Turing thesis.
But we're not
going down this path right now because we have to eat lunch. All right. So let me wrap up and then we can do this over lunch. So my point about raising these sex generic reals is if there's a way to map everything so theoretically, they have some nice properties, both in terms of this limiting behavior, these right, every limit point is a member, every member is a limit point, suggests a way to think about this problem of how close do you have to be for all intents and purposes. At the same time, there's sort of these atomic kernels of information that you can't throw stuff out of. So I put that out there. And finally then, let me show again my summary and conclusion slide that I started with, except it's got one more line here so I can say a word about the two earlier talks. And obviously happy to continue these discussions. So we started out by saying, what's the information content of a real number? We identified some questions that we have to encounter, and we think about that. I suggested that we take the James's principle in its verbal form as our guiding principle because it is generalizable in a way that doesn't really refer to the particular number system or set of mathematics that you're using, model of mathematics you're using. We come up with the notion that the way we think about doing physics as theorists versus experimenters leads us to different kinds of numbers, and I would say that the main difference, if I switched from intervals to some other kind of statistical notion, it would just be another notion of genericity. Whether or not this dream is doable, who knows? But if it is, this is where the Sachs generic reals, I think, would play a role. And finally, two comments on the two papers from earlier that I made reference to. So the first one is, if we think about the coin game and finding out the probability distribution, this comes exactly to what Fred had to say, which is that Bob tossing the coin is in fact putting in information other than the fact that I've gotten a sequence of heads, heads, tails, tails, heads, 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 but is putting in information, some model of what the coin is doing, with the notion that the statistical distribution of these first 20 tries or 200 tries, in fact, tells me something about the statistical distribution going all the way out. So that one approach this saying that we, in fact, are not talking about generic reals, that we're putting in some model of nature, and when you put in that model of nature, genericity goes out. But when genericity goes out, then also we're not really talking about real numbers anymore because we're restricting to some class of numbers where there's some initial, where I know something beyond just what the finite initial segment is. So that's my delayed answer to your question. The second comment has to do with the question of teleportation and encoding. You know, if I can compute, send two real numbers with two bits, why can't I send 2,000 real numbers? And I have two answers to that. One might be that actually you can, and we just haven't thought about it cleverly enough of how you embed the real numbers. But the alternative answer is that, in fact, we shouldn't just be thinking about these as real numbers. It really matters that they're the theta and phi of the qubit state, and that if I were to try to merge them into a single real number, would there be a way to do that? Well, I can write down an algorithm that will do that, But then I have to include the implementation of that algorithm in there. And so in some sense, it's really not that we're sending two real numbers with two qubits. That's not the right way to think about it. But that there's some algorithmic formulation of what it is that we're sending. Because otherwise, two real numbers and one real number, it's the same amount of information. And then how that algorithmic formulation would be embedded in would have something to do with what our physics and so forth. And there's not a good answer for that, but it's, it tells us that we need to think a little bit more carefully, I think, about what those terms mean. So with that, I think I'm done. Thank you all. So there are lots of questions during the talk, and people want to have lunch. But if there are one or two pressing questions, I can do that, or we can just break now. Nate?
I can wait till later.
We'll do one question, maybe two.
Okay. Maybe I'll ask a ridiculous question, because I thought about this, and I thought it was sort of, it came to my mind again during Phil's talk, and this is maybe just sort of an open, ridiculous question. So say I wanted to make this coin, but I don't care whether I'm flipping it or not. What I actually want to communicate to the person is I just literally make the mass of the coin something between 0 and pi over 2. And so this sort of, I don't even know, like, right, because that's the kind of information is I'm going to say they're going to be able to measure the mass to the 10th decimal place, converted to bits, that would be 36 bits. I mean, so I don't even know, like, what is the most information we've ever tried to communicate, so to speak, in a number? You know, does that make sense?
Well, I mean, so it depends. If you really think of the mass as a continuous variable, then you're trying to send a real number with a real number, and then you have to ask, how do you make that real number for the mass? You haven't solved the problem. You've just
right.
got, it's the first causes problem of, you know, theology, just in the real number sense. And if you're doing it to saying that I have some way of specifying the mass to some precision, then I'm not sure that's computationally distinguishable from just tossing a coin a lot of times, right? So, I mean, so unlike data, right, I'm taking this view of, you know, the worst kind of theorist's view of, well, it's not computationally distinguishable. Beyond that, I don't really care. Qubits, qdits, I don't care, right? I want to know just sort of what's computable, right? Obviously, in the real world, I do care, right? I mean, so I'm all for that, but just in this problem, I'm really trying to think of it in this sense. So, but yeah, I mean, and if you really think about that, that all these things are ways of communicating information, then you've already recast all of it.
Just give you a coin, and if it's one, one means the complete works of Shakespeare, and if it's zero, it doesn't communicate anything, right? I can make any amount of information one bit if I just have the right code.
If you want to talk about communicating information,
yeah.
So I'll just tell, this is a talk I heard, and then we'll go to lunch, but Ben Schumacher gave, I don't know, 15 years ago or something, and it was, as I recall, it was a story about his brother, and his brother had some summer job out in some state, national park or something or other out in the West Coast, and it was the days before cell phones, and his brother would call if there was a problem. So every day there wasn't a phone call, they knew there wasn't a problem. And then there were big floods out there, and the phone lines were down. The information channel went away. So yes, you can encode information in a lot of ways, right? The fact that they didn't get a call meant something, and then it didn't mean something. So, you know, I think that. But maybe on that note, we should all go eat some lunch, and we'll be back here at 1:30, yes?
1:30.
Ask one of the organizers, I don't know. Thank you all.